The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by Breed Smith, former People Before Profit TD. Breed, how are you today?
Good, thanks very much.
Good to see you. We're getting stuck into Christmas sandwiches a little bit later on, Breed, so keep that space ready. And Mark Hennessy, Ireland and Britain editor of the Irish Times. Mark, you're very welcome.
Good morning.
How are you? Very dramatic story to start with, and it's this fracas at the Mater. The chairman has resigned after an extraordinary outburst saying, you're not God to the health minister. My God. You think there should be more of this kind of stuff, Mark?
Well, I mean, if you go through the details of it, a meeting in July between the minister and a team of Mater executives and the chairman, David Begg, and it fairly quickly, it would seem, descended into a row. She was very critical of a number of things in the hospital, including the number of procedures being done, making the point, as I understand it, from the Irish Independent today, that a lot more money had been put in and they weren't getting the outputs that they wanted. And this prompted a row. And as you said, David Begg said, you may be Minister for Health, but you're not God. Now, frankly, I would have thought she then subsequently demanded an apology. Personally, I would prefer to see people talking more openly to each other in private about these things. I don't think there's anything wrong with having a private row, quite frankly. I mean, David Begg is somebody who's been in Irish public life for very many decades. He's no mug. You know, and he's not somebody who goes out of his way.
That's the experience.
Yeah, and he's not somebody who goes out of his way to pick and fights with people. The minister on this particular occasion arrived 45 minutes early for the appointment, and she went wandering around the hospital on her own, which again is something that ministers should do. It's also something that hospitals hate.
But because do they do it?
No, they don't, as a rule. So, I mean, fair juice to her on that score.
So it was a bit of a solo run, really, is it?
Oh, it's entirely a solo run, but to be fair, there is a benefit in ministers seeing what they want to see in a hospital without it being sent through a prism of what the hospital wants you to see.
Yeah.
So that's on her credit column there. On the other hand, ending up in a row and then demanding an apology for something that I would have regarded as being plain speaking on both sides is probably unnecessary as well. Begg is somebody who has, to give him his due, has done some service. You know,
if you were just in a normal company and a member of the management arrives unbidden and starts making its way down the corridors, there would be an immediate reaction, though, wouldn't there? There'd be a bit of a, this isn't how we do this. You need it.
I'm not sure. Well, in private companies, I'd be very surprised if you had,
not private companies.
No?
No more. I think in a private company, it can happen any day. I own this company. I'm going to walk down whatever corridor I want.
Yeah.
But in a public service setting, would you not think?
No. I accept it doesn't happen. Yeah. But my point is, we might be better off if there was a bit more of it.
Yeah. You have to roll the ball back a long way.
You would have to roll the ball back a long way.
There's a wider context of this, though, and it's ironic that this happened in the Mater.
Yeah.
Because it's right next door to the most successful, most profitable private hospital in the country. And the minister and her party are the ones who, more than anybody else, stick up for private medicine and its role in the health service. When, in fact, two-tier medicine is what causes a huge problem with budgets, with the idea that there's long waiting lists, consultants working in private medicine, other therapists and experts working in private medicine, and the public sector suffers as a result. And she was having a go over the staff and their role in the matter. According to the article, Begg was sticking up for the staff. But if you put it in the context of a two-tier medical system in a country that really doesn't need that, we need a one-tier medical system where the best of health is available to everybody at the point of need rather than the size of your wallet. And what we've got is the opposite. So I think the context of it matters as well.
Right. What do you think, though, of his reaction? I mean,
I could understand it. I mean, you know, Jennifer Carroll McNeill is not exactly subtle. And she would, you know, for a lot of people who would, if he was taking cognizance of the fact that the staff are always under pressure, and she came in with her bold, loud manner to say, I don't accept that, he would feel obliged to defend him. But I do think that he would also, you know, he wouldn't do it out of just, you know, I got out of the wrong side of the bed. He'd be quite cautious. He's a man who's played a role of negotiating and, you know, stabilising between two fighting sides all his life. So he wouldn't have done it without real purpose for doing it. And I think he probably was defending, instinctively defending the staff. But I do think the wider context matters.
Yeah.
That if you're propping up a private medical system and come into the public health service and say, this is awful, this is disgraceful, enough isn't being done. Well, I'm sorry, there's a root cause to that.
Right. Still, for him to quit, and with his background in unions, and he's involved in the WCR as well, he knows the road at this point, and staff in particular, in defending them. Is quitting the right thing to do?
Well, I mean, it's clear, judging from the context of the story, that Marta executives and other members of the board weren't happy with what he did. Because certainly, you know, you had executives running down the corridor after the minister apologising for what happened and all of that. So clearly, you know, I think there's an internal issue within the matter. I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that I think there are arguments in favour of both of them in different parts of this row. You know, I do think there's a role for a Minister for Health to be interventionist, to be bolshy, to be pushing people along. There's equally a role for somebody like Beg to say, you know, we're a hospital in the north side of Dublin with a large cohort of the largest cohort of elderly patients. We have legacy debt and a whole variety of other issues. And you, the minister, are not listening to us. So,
absolutely.
But my broader point is, I would much prefer to see people talking like this in private at meetings like this, where there's actually a proper engagement and where people know what each other's side is, rather than
exchange of views going, but do it privately.
Yeah.
On to Charlie Kirk. This is a fascinating story, and it's playing out very quickly. They have the assumed assassin in custody already. But I have to say that the number of people who had never heard of Charlie Kirk prior to this is phenomenal.
The number of people of our age.
Exactly.
Who hadn't heard of it.
Yes.
I mean, talk to any 18, 20-year-old.
You know,
they all seem to know about it.
And they came to me immediately. Yeah. They said, did you see?
Yeah.
And they seem to know all about this man. And yet he's a presence that, as you say, people are aware of.
Well, I mean, his podcast last year, according to the New York Times, turned over just shy of $100 million. $130 million downloads. Uniquely significant for Trump in his election. He reached parts, like he literally was Heineken. He literally reached parts that nobody was able to get to in terms of young men and indeed young women, it would appear, despite the content of much of his messaging. A hugely divisive figure. And, you know, like, firstly, nobody should get killed for their political views. So let's hammer that home. But equally, don't paint Charlie Kirk into being some sort of latter-day angel and saint, because some of his views, and you can see the piece in the Irish Times with some of his opinions expressed.
What he says are absolutely remarkable. He says, if I see a black pilot, I'm going to be like, God, I hope he's qualified. He says, if I'm dealing with somebody in customer service who's a moronic black woman, I wonder, is she there because of her excellence or some affirmative action?
Yeah, and it goes on in that vein. I mean, there are plenty more that can be, and for instance, his message about Taylor Swift on the day her engagement was announced, reject feminism, submit to your husband, Taylor, you're not in charge, you know. So this is somebody who was, you know, ramping up the rhetoric.
Yeah.
You know, and you now have a president who, when faced with something like this, makes no attempt at trying to unite people, makes no attempt to the Democratic state Congress people in Minnesota who were killed and who got no half-mast flag treatment from. And he is winding things up in an extraordinarily dangerous way, which are going to have extraordinarily bad consequences.
I totally agree with that. I think that the Trump regime is violence itself. You know, it's written all over it. And I think that the gun laws are at the heart of this. Now, you said to me earlier on, we're not going to be able to do anything about that. 300 million weapons in America. Mm. You can go shopping for a gun as easy as you can for underwear.
Yeah.
You know, it's mad. And it's ironic that somebody who stood up for the lack of gun control, who said, no, let's keep the amendment and let's not control guns, is killed because of this. You know, ultimately, that's the reason a 22-year-old was able to get his hand on a powerful weapon. And had obviously trained at being a marksman, either in the woods or something, because he was able to do something not many people could do. Go at 200 yards, get straight for the neck with one shot.
Yeah.
So, look, and quite a middle-class young man himself. Not your sort of typical Arab or black who's going to go out or even, you know, sort of defending trans rights or something. So it's all a mess. But I do agree with you that there's been other political acts of violence. The senator and husband were killed. Mm. There was no half-mast flag flying then. And I also think that the regime itself, and you look at that story during the week of the Irish grandmother who's in solitary confinement, having spent 50 years in the States, working, paying her taxes, reared her family, and she's now locked up because of the violence of ICE. Snatch squads going out and saying, right, we're taking you. And how many people has this happened to have disappeared and have been treated badly? And then look at the violence that's taken place around the world. And extraordinarily, I'm surprised it's not on the papers, is this business of renaming the Department of Defence the Department of War.
It's hard to believe, isn't
and
it?
And the what they call the Minister for War or the Secretary for War, Pete Hegseth, says, we are going on the offence, not the defence. We're using maximum lethality, not trepid legality. Violent effect, not politically correct. Hello?
Yeah.
What sort of a regime is running America and therefore the world?
That other aspect of this, that our kids knew about it and that they're learning a lot of this through, it's TikTok, isn't mm-hmm. it, really, where they're getting most mm-hmm. of this. Mm-hmm. They're being exposed to a whole news source that we don't know very much about, do we?
Yeah, but
and which they've.
They're being exposed to a whole news source that it's not a news source. I mean, it's there's no attempts at checks, there's no attempts at trying to confirm or anything else, and it's all coming through in an unfiltered way. There will be times when that will be uniquely advantageous to public knowledge, there's no doubt about that. But you look at the number of young people who have seen somebody on video being shot with blood spurting out of his neck, and they're looking at it.
They've
almost...
Seen it.
Yeah, they have seen
which
it.
Which I find
yeah.
phenomenal because I haven't.
Yeah, no, I haven't looked either.
And, And they also, they tell me stuff, and they're very extreme. They were telling me stories about there were messages written on the bullets and things like this. They believe all of this, and it's very extreme. It's very dramatic.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely but not
on our radar. I mean, what we've seen in the last year with Trump, civilization and political institutions are a very thin veneer on a society. And the idea that when, you know, people look back to Germany in the 30s and, you know, how could people behave like they did in February 32 and all of the rest of it, this stuff can disappear in a week if people aren't careful. There's a reason why democracy needs institutions to survive and structure. You need a court that's independent. You need a legislature that is attempting to work together on dealing with problems. And you need political leadership that seeks in some way to try and bridge gaps rather than create them.
And it's very far from that in the States at the moment, it has to be said. To look at our own presidential election, it's kind of the main runners are kind of becoming a lot more clear at this point. A lot of the names are falling to the side. It looks like we've three really, Heather Humphreys, Fianna Gael, Jim Gavin, Fianna Fáil and Catherine Connolly at the moment, independent. One or two others coming through. Maria Sheen, maybe, Steen, making a late...
Well...
Ron, what do you think, Breed, yourself?
Well, I don't know if Maria Steen will make it. Certainly, Paddy Tobin is doing his best to make sure she makes it, and he's getting amazing coverage for a party with two TDs. There's extraordinary coverage on the media, and explain that one. But I think if Maria Steen does make it, that she will try to twist this whole election to being about abortion. That is her passion. She was so anti-repeal, so, you know, outspoken on that. Same-sex marriage as well. But she will go, and Tobin has made no secret of it, that he wants a new referendum to put the Eighth Amendment back into the Constitution. And I think that that's what they'll make it about. But they'll have a fight in their hands because there's no going back. We're not going back into the dark ages where women don't have a right to decide whether they have a child or don't have a child, and where crisis pregnancies are dealt with by exporting them or allowing them to go ignored. And I think that is what she would try to do. Very conservative Catholic, very right-wing on the question of immigration, already talking about, you know, how immigration frightens people. We're not able to accept and absorb the different cultures. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. And it's whipped up. What she really should be talking about, if she cares about families, women and children as much, is the cost of living and the fact that there's so many people homeless, and how is the government going to deal with that? But of course, that's, we'd be told, is not the role of a president. Those economic issues that go to the heart of what is unjust and unequal in this society are not raised by her.
Sure. She's very unlikely, though, isn't she, to make the running, really. And if she did, she'd be a lone voice from that side.
Well, I mean, I would have thought that's the politically advantageous place for her to be. I would disagree, if I may, with Breed, because I don't think she will make this campaign about abortion, because I think politically that would narrow her ground. I think she will try to be a much more broad range of conservative issues, of which abortion will be one. And I do think that there's a place for her on this electoral list, because there's no doubt, and if you look at public opinion, there has been a leaning right in terms of public opinion on a whole variety of issues. And if she is suitably subtle, and she may not be, if she gets on the ticket, I think there's a well of support for her to mine. But equally, you're looking at the council appearances. It's not clear that the councillors are actually going to take the power that they have to nominate. They do like being asked.
They do.
And understandably, given in many ways it's one of the few things that is kind of entirely in their gift. One of the things I must say I'm slightly surprised about is why Peter Casey, who was once upon a time so prominent, he's on the list, yet nobody... He doesn't appear to have done anything to have actually raised his profile in recent times. So I find that mildly curious.
Skeletons are remaining firmly in closets. There is no sign of anything being brought into the daylight at this point. Just to talk to you quickly about the cost of living, because it seems to be something that just isn't going away. There was a feeling that it had passed, that we were kind of moving out of the cost of living crisis. But that's not really what we're reading in the papers today at all.
Yeah, well, anecdotally, and probably all of us here in the studio would feel it and see it as well. The price of food in particular is going up all the time. I think food inflation is about 5% at the moment. And although the figures don't mean anything to anybody when you say percentages, people do see the price of basics like milk, bread, butter, pasta, the basics that you need to feed a family, in particular the sort of basics that people who can't afford all of the range of fresh fruit and vegetables and organic foods who do rely on these basics can feel the pinch of their basket costs going up all of the time. And now the energy prices by double digits. So this idea that the solution to your energy bills is to shop around is nonsense, because energy might have been the cheapest 2 years ago when we were talking about the energy prices. But now they've said, oh God, we have to catch up. Yeah. And they're doubling their double figure increase.
You do definitely have to shop around. Because
you have to shop around, but it's not
a cost level that... They will only discount if you move.
Absolutely, I don't disagree with that, but that's how competition and silly market things work. But nevertheless, it doesn't get at the underlying problem of why is energy being pushed on the consumer at such a high price? And the profits being made by the energy companies.
It doesn't ever seem to have really gone down. After all of the spikes, there were the huge, it came down a little bit, but nothing like it went up.
Yeah. But I mean, not defending energy companies for a moment, because I just got my notice from BGE last night, and I shopped around in the last year and hadn't done it for a number of years. So, you know, bigger fool me. So there's no doubt that we should all be much tougher. I remember living in Belgium, you know, 25 years ago, and the number of times I can remember being in supermarkets and you would have a middle-aged, obviously, you know, reasonably comfortably off woman, absolutely berating the manager over a rise in price in something. We don't do that.
It seems to be part of our...
It's part of our culture to just suck it up and take it. So we should be more cantankerous when we see things. I mean, I had an example myself during the week with something where, you know, I should have said something. I just walked out the door, you know. Again,
but I don't think it's the individual managers and shops that are putting the prices up.
No. It's not. Of course, it's not individual managers. I'm making the point that there's a different customer attitude displayed, that we are far too...
We don't complain. My wife is always saying it, either in restaurants or anywhere.
Yeah, no, we don't. But just on the energy thing, I mean, just look at some of the reasons for what's going up. Russian pipeline gas deliveries to the EU still going on despite the war. Yeah. They've fallen by 45% year on year, partly because of the halt to gas transit across the Ukraine. Supplies from Norway, critical, have declined because of maintenance issues. And European Union storage ended up in the spring 50% below where it should be.
Right.
So this year you've got every continental country trying to buy gas in advance of winter, and that's going to mean that there's going to be more of this stuff.
Right, brilliant. Let's cheer ourselves up and talk about Margot Robbie and her obvious lifelong fascination with tato sandwiches, I'd say, by the looks of her.
Well, as I said earlier on, and you said it yourself, try a King crisp sandwich, much nicer. The advantage of King as well is it's also suitable for vegans. And that's not an ad for King.
How has Margot come to the world of tato sandwiches at this point in her life?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, I'll add the detail here. Apparently, Colin Farrell introduced her to her favourite new snack on the set of the film that they're just launching last week, A Big, Bold, Beautiful Journey. And apparently how he used to bring in a chippy sandwich, as she calls it here, every single day and put it in my trailer when I get to work.
Did he really?
Now, judging by the look of her, I doubt very much if she's eating too many
but
of them.
But you know what? I think when you're at that level and you're in the gym 8 hours a day, you can eat anything you want.
Exactly.
Really?
I don't know.
I confess I appear to be the only person on this panel who has never eaten a crisp sandwich.
Have you never had a crisp sandwich?
No, I know. I will fix this, but I haven't got around to it yet.
I think they're one of life's great pleasures.
I take your word for it, clearly.
Would you be
It has to have loads of butter on it.
Loads of butter, yeah. I sometimes do a little sprinkling of cheese as well, because I'm a bit mad. But yes.
And a pint of Guinness. Swiss, it'd be nice.
Or tea. Tea is lovely with
cup
as well.
Of tea, right.
It melts the butter. It's beautiful.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.